Welcome, and thank you for standing by. I'd like to remind all parties that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I'd like to go ahead and turn the call over to your host for today, to Mr. John Engler, President of Business Roundtable. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us. We've got a number of people on the phone and quite a few people right here in the BRT offices. So as was indicated, I'm John Engler, President of Business Roundtable, and Gary Lovin, Chairman, CEO, and President of Caesars Entertainment Corporation, is right beside me on the phone. Randall Stevenson, Chairman, CEO of AT&T, and Professor Lovin chairs our Health and Retirement Committee, and Randall is the Vice Chair of that committee. And also, close at hand here is Maria Gazelle, our Vice President, who has been the leader on the healthcare issues here for a long time, and one of our outside counsels, Nancy Taylor, she's there beside her. So I think Randy Davis is here as well. So we've got a good group. The roundtable, just refresh everyone in case there's anybody that may not be up to date. 210 CEOs of America's leading companies representing all sectors of the economy: manufacturing, retail, financial services, technology, hospitality, construction services. And they comprise nearly a third of the value of the U.S. stock market, employ millions of U.S. workers, and the top priority of the Business Roundtable is economic growth and job creation. And the topic that we're going to discuss today, modernizing and protecting our social safety nets, is critical to economic growth. We're going to ensure that Social Security and Medicare are available to our employees today and to future generations, then I think it's important that we act with a sense of urgency. And we believe that the current discussion on spending and the deficit affords a timely opportunity. And over the past year, led by Gary Lubman and Randall Stevenson, the BRT CEOs have engaged in a rigorous analysis of these programs, a lot of discussions, and always with the goal of preserving the system for those who have retired or are nearing retirement, even as we make certain that the program survives for future generations. We believe that the Business Roundtable purpose and our role in public policy debates is to help solve problems. So we want to put forth a thoughtful solution to some of the nation's greatest challenges. And so that's what you're going to hear about today from these two outstanding CEOs. And Randall and Gary are going to give you a brief overview of the CEO recommendations for entitlement modernization. Then we're going to open it up pretty quickly for some questions. So I think without further delay, I should turn it over to Gary. I should also mention, though, I sort of made reference that Gary has a PhD in economics from MIT and was a professor of economics at the Harvard Business School. So he is a deep analytical thinker and focused very intently on the realities of our Social Security and Medicare finance systems. And he found this to be a challenging problem. Everybody's got some ideas. Gary?
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us, and Governor, for the introduction. I am encouraged by what I found as I've returned to the set of issues defined by the committee that Randall and I lead. The BRT needs to help inform policymakers on a way to address three fundamental issues facing the American economy. The first, of course, is to recognize that the economy remains weak. The pace of recovery is disappointing to all of us. The second is that long-term fiscal reform is necessary if the economy's rate of growth is to trend to a level sufficient to generate net employment at a level we'd all like to see. And third, all decision-makers in the economy certainly need a higher level of stability and predictability than we've experienced recently. So if you then decompose that problem into some of its most important constituent elements, you find that the growth of entitlements is the largest presenting problem by far, with entitlements now constituting some 42% of the federal budget and projected to be the majority of the federal budget by 2021. So Randall's committee and I, we have looked at what must be done to try to make pragmatic changes that occur slowly and predictably to those who are recipients or prospective recipients of both Social Security and Medicare that would sustain the security they provide to the recipients who need the programs most, reduce the trend rate of growth in the programs, and rationalize some of the things that have occurred since these programs were instituted a long time ago in a way that supports the broader fiscal effort that I've just described. I would argue, having come to this in the last year and a half or so, that the news is generally quite positive. That is, Americans are living longer and in better health. than was true at the time these programs were constituted. I think we all agree that. No one would have imagined when these programs were first instituted that they would come to occupy such a large portion of the recipient's lifetime. My father, who was an employee of AT&T for more than 40 years, retired at age 61 and lived to be 95. He was a 34-year recipient of Social Security benefits, something that near his death he noted to me with great pride that he had been on both Randall's payroll and the federal government's payroll for much longer than anyone could possibly have anticipated. That's, of course, generally speaking, good news, but it's a problem the country simply can't afford over a sustained period of time. So working with our committee that includes the CEOs of healthcare providers, healthcare insurers, healthcare technology companies, and the broader membership of the BRT, Randall and I have put forward a set of recommendations on behalf of the BRT that we think speak to the central elements that need modification for these programs to continue to deliver what all of us would like them to deliver. The first is that their fundamental demographic criteria need to be modernized. Today, Social Security begins to kick in over time when one reaches 67 years of age. Medicare begins when one reaches 65 years of age. As we all live longer, healthier lives, the burden the government faces looking after people for a very sustained period of time increases, and I think we ought to recognize that that was never its intention, and we need to gradually increase the age at which we all become eligible for these benefits. This would happen very gradually. It would not affect anyone who is today 55 years of age or older. It would give everyone a very long horizon for planning, and I think it is generally quite a sensible approach to a predictable demographic problem. Second, we would argue that the rising trend rate of cost in the Medicare system can be addressed by the introduction of competition in Medicare. As you know, Medicare is a fee-for-service product. In certain portions of Medicare, particularly Part D, there is today competition that has helped arrest the trend rate of growth in that category. We would argue that there ought to be available to seniors wide choices, both existing Medicare and private alternatives, and seniors fully informed would be able to make their own choice as to which program best suits them. The benefit of private competition for large numbers of seniors who would make this election, we believe, would lead to a more efficient allocation of medical resources, better outcomes, and a lower trend rate of growth in medical costs. Third, the current Social Security system today has a cost of living escalator built into it that modestly overstates the rate of inflation that seniors experience. We would argue that that escalator ought to be modified, and I emphasize again very modestly, from the current CPI index that's used that looks at a fixed basket of goods to what's called the chain-weighted CPI that allows the index to reflect the fact that all of us make decisions to modify our purchase when we see relative prices change. And then fourth and finally, we argue that there ought to be greater means testing for recipients of benefits in both programs. So to the degree one is a higher income earner, a wealthier recipient when one reaches the ages of eligibility, the benefits available to higher income, wealthier participants ought to be relatively lower than would be the case currently. When you provide these four categories of modifications to the program, again, all of them occurring very gradually over a long period of time, you arrest a large portion of the rate of increase in Medicare expense, therefore putting much less burden on the federal budget circumstance, and you make the Social Security system solvent for the next 75 years. So let me pause there and turn to my colleague Randall and let him add a few words to this description. Randall?
Okay, thank you, Gary. And I'll be very brief so we can get to the question and answer session. But before doing that, I do want to just commend and thank Gary for the leadership he's shown on this issue. He's brought an incredible amount of intellectual firepower and energy and coalescing 200 CEOs of the BRT around these sensible proposals was no easy task. There are not a lot of wallflowers in the BRT, and in bringing us to a place of a cohesive and comprehensive proposal like this was an impressive feat, and I thank Gary for that effort. As John and Gary have said, we believe very strongly that our modernization recommendations must be included in any reform, in any budget deal that's agreed to by the President and Congress. There is a sense of urgency around this. We've said all along that Congress and the administration are going to have to take some very real and meaningful steps to reform entitlements if we're going to rein in federal spending. And modernizing Medicare and Social Security to meet both the current fiscal as well as the demographic realities that you heard Gary describe will go an incredibly long way towards getting America's fiscal house back in order. while preserving a basic safety net for both future generations as well as future retirees. And so we believe now is the time for America's leaders to step up and act. It needs to be done for the good of the country as a whole. And any, if we fail to stabilize our federal debt and get a control on spending, the implications to markets in terms of market disruption and economic growth, it's not a question of if it happens, it's just a question of when it happens. And so we believe that this must be avoided. And as Gary pointed out, with some very rational and sensible actions, it can be avoided. And so with that, I'll turn it back to you, John.
Thank you very much, Randall and Gary. Very good overview. The CEOs of the roundtable are fully committed to the recommendations, and we're going to press Congress and administration to understand what these roundtable recommendations are and for action on the recommendations. And so with that, let's open it up and get into the conversation here. So let's go first. Jim?
You guys have talked about raising the debt limit.
And since Randall can't see you, I'll just maybe Jim Spencer, sure, of Minneapolis Star Tribune, and everybody can introduce themselves in the future.
You've talked about raising the debt limit, and I think in a conversation we had, you talked about preferring to have it raised for as much as 5 years so to get that behind you. The president's already said he doesn't want to tie anything to raising the debt limit. Do you think that this proposal, do you all see this proposal as needing to be tied to the debt limit negotiations?
No, I mean, we're not. We don't even enact, as much as we might like to, enact laws over here at the roundtable. We try to put out solid policy recommendations. So we don't tie anything to anything else, but I would say that the debt ceiling is going to have to be addressed. I think that this is much more relevant to the whole budget conversation and long-term deficit issue. This is something that we think when you look long-term at the United States fiscal health, it's, as Gary said, unavoidable. You have to deal with these questions. And so we're not putting these forward to gain leverage. We're putting these forward to get this conversation going here. We need to act, and this is part of a growth strategy. When we get some certainty on our fiscal affairs in this country, I think it's a stronger, better climate for jobs and growth.
Damian Paletta with the Wall Street Journal. For Gary and Randall, were there any lessons learned during the fiscal cliff negotiations? Obviously, you guys tried to be more vocal, and at the end, it seems like the CEOs were kind of ignored at the end of the day. How do you think you can be more relevant in the next 6 months as Washington debates the budget deficit?
I hesitate to even try to answer that because it's hard for me to gauge how relevant we were or weren't. I would only argue that you see in these recommendations and the tone that Randall and I and our colleagues make, we are fundamentally pragmatic.
Mm-hmm.
We approach these not in the game theory of the politics that seems to have captured everyone's attention, but rather around the concrete nature of the problems we're asked to address and how we can find solutions that seem to be constructive when there's a set of constraints around how those decisions have to be made. In this case, the preservation of security for seniors, the need to address the federal budget problem, demographic realities that frame the problem, we try to have a solution. And what I think we did prior to the fiscal cliff discussion was to simply suggest to our leaders that nothing was off the table as far as CEOs were concerned, whether that was revenue generation, spending reductions, all these things we thought needed to be debated professionally and some resolution reached. And we put a great priority on the need to reach some resolution so that we didn't experience this tremendous economic disruption associated with falling off cliff. Randall, would you add anything to that?
No, I think it's very well said. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, all we can do as CEOs is present data, present information, and present arguments. And that's what we're here doing this afternoon and laying out for both Congress as well as the American people a plan that, quite frankly, as Gary keeps saying, that it's implemented over a long period of time. It would give people plenty of time to plan around it, and would significantly go a long way towards addressing the fiscal situation in this country. And so, I don't have any grandiose expectations for how this will be received. All we can do is put it out and continue to have the dialogue and the conversation with Congress.
Yeah, I think that's our obligation. I don't even necessarily, you know, were CEOs ignored or was everybody ignored? I mean, this went down to the last day of the year, the first day of the new year, pretty unappealing process, I think, no matter where you're positioned along the ideological spectrum or where you're positioned along the economic spectrum. So I just think that I privileged to head an organization here with 210 CEOs, leaders who in their own companies time and time again have faced tough, vexing challenges, and they've had to make hard decisions, but you make them, and you move on. And I think the frustration that the CEOs have with Washington is that the people in charge of our own government have got to be able to work together and get these decisions made.
Yes, ma'am. I'm Laura Montgomery with the Washington Post. I'm curious, you appear to have rejected the idea of increasing revenues for Social Security. I'm wondering why, and did you have any specific ideas for increasing private savings?
Let me take the first part, and John or Randall take the second. We don't necessarily reject anything. The argument about Social Security is that it's intended to be a supplement to one's individual retirement planning that is not primarily an income redistribution vehicle. Now, we did say in this set of recommendations that we would advocate some level of means testing on the level of benefit that higher income people experience. You would have to raise the base upon which the taxes are applied very substantially to drive a sufficient level of revenue to address the long-term problems of the program. And when compared to the kinds of issues that we proposed, that would be far more damaging to economic growth than what we're asking people to consider. If you raise the tax rate on people who earn over the current threshold, you'll have an immediate deleterious effect on economic activity. Whereas what we're proposing here is a series of modifications that feather into the system over a long period of time, but lead to a very favorable result. So that's why we come out much more in favor of this position. Private savings, we're not re-engaging the Bush debate about the substitution of a private program for the federal program. We're simply suggesting that the existing programs that encourage individuals to save certainly should be sustained, and to the degree there's an appetite for making it more attractive, that ought also to be. I would tell you anecdotally that in companies like mine, we administer a 401k program with a match from the company, and it's very hard to get many of our employees to make that decision, even though they're foregoing a tax benefit and the match. And we run extensive, I'm sure Randall does exactly the same thing, extensive programs encouraging people to consider the benefit of making these decisions, and a very large percentage of our employees don't. And we could go into a long discussion about why that's the case. But anything that would lead to a higher level of incremental savings on their part, we think would be desirable.
David Morgan with Reuters. How much savings would these proposals provide to the federal budget over the next 10 years to estimate? And what provisions do you have for people who may not be so healthy when they start to reach the higher range of their 60s. I mean, the Institute of Medicine came out with a study last week that showed that Americans live less healthy lives and die earlier than their peers in other industrialized countries. And, of course, the problem with obesity could pose issues down the road that would make people less healthy and less able to survive to 70 before they retire.
So let's take those in two parts. The Medicare proposal we put forward would save $300 billion against the current baseline projection in the first 10 years of its implementation. That number is smaller than the program might suggest it would be because it phases itself in a very gradual way. Over the longer period, over the 25-year period, the savings would be in the neighborhood of $6 trillion because the eligibility age modifications and many of the other things have a disproportionately larger impact later in the period between the 10th and the 25th year. With respect to Social Security, these modifications would allow the institution to declare itself solvent for 75 years, which is the typical standard it wishes to achieve once these modifications were implemented. With respect to the debate over what to do for seniors who are between the current age of eligibility for Medicare and what we're proposing, there are a couple of things to consider, one technical and one more substantive. On the more substantive case, the Affordable Care Act begins to introduce a subsidy to low-income seniors before the eligibility age would kick in. So if you were a low-income senior, as you watched the eligibility age rising ahead of you and you were in a demographic such that it would be relevant to you, the intersection of these things should not leave you in a gap. The arguments about life expectancy are interesting. If you look at American life expectancy, we suffer because a lot of American men die very young due to violence, automobile accidents, and other factors. If you point out that particularly men reach a certain age, if you say conditional on living 40, what's your conditional life expectancy at that point? The numbers are much more appealing, and these things often get blurred in the debate. So I think the demographics, in my view, suggest that people are going to live longer and healthier lives, and as a result, we need to be cognizant of how much the country can afford to spend under the current system and ratchet that back to reflect rising expectancy.
Hey, Gary, if I could add one thing to that, and that is that this proposal dovetails very nicely with the demographic realities of the workforce. And what I mean by that is at AT&T, and I think most of us in corporate America, as we look out the next 10 to 15 years, we're going to need our employees to work longer just to fill the needs that we have in the workforce. And so the idea that we're going to push out over an extended period of time the eligibility age for Social Security and Medicare dovetails very nicely with the need that we're going to have in corporate America to have people working longer. And so we're putting in plans and instituting plans to accommodate that. So it's a very nice congruence between the two objectives.
And, if I could, going back, picking up on a question Laurie asked about revenues, you actually have a revenue cost to companies with the longer stretching out there, because now instead of persons leaving corporate payroll, if the age is going to go later, you're going to be on the company's coverage or policy that much longer. That's not scoreable in here as a revenue source, but it is it's part of how the cost savings is achieved. And I think Gary's point is really needs to be focused on, because it is the power, it's sort of like the power of compound interest, but it's sort of the power of compound savings here. If you can start to save a little bit now and you run that out over a few decades, it really adds up. And it's also the argument why you would act now versus putting this off and saying, well, we can get by. We can make it. I mean, I was looking at the Medicare trustees report, and Secretary Geithner and Secretary Sebelius are trustees, but I mean, they're reporting 7 years in a row. We've fallen below where we need to be. In April, I'm sure it'll be the eighth year. And they make the point very clearly that if you act earlier and the changes are more gradual, it's much easier. Well, that's, Congress needs to pay attention to that too. And it's literally the people in the Congress who vote for this, very few of them will be really still, well, I guess I would say, normally that would be the case, and Congress, sometimes they stay a long time, but there wouldn't be that many of them still be serving by the time these actual changes really start to kick in. So,
I'm James Pleady with the Financial Times. From a practical point of view, 70, why pick 70 as the age when even getting a more modest increase in the eligibility age for both Social Security and Medicare has been so difficult, and even since those only went up to 69? On Social Security. And also, when you look at the Medicare proposal, and you're talking about private plans, how do you feel about premium support in combination with that?
Well, premium support is essentially what we're arguing. We're saying that the government would give you a subsidy of premium support that would allow you to then go shop for care, and there would be a series of competing alternatives certified to be eligible in your state or your broader geographic region, and then you would use that benefit to choose among competing plans, remembering that Medicare would be one of those. So you could always take Medicare under the existing circumstances if you decided that suited you best. With respect to, and I'll come back in a moment to why we favor that view, but with respect to why, there's nothing magical about 70. I think the view of my fellow CEOs was, if we're going to fight this battle, recognizing that these battles are very difficult to fight, better to fight it for a meaningful change that is consistent with demographic reality rather than fight it for a very modest increase and then have to go fight it again. Now, people could reasonable people to disagree about that. But recognizing that no one under 55 is affected by this, so by the time someone who is no one over 55 is affected by this. So if you're 54, you're now going to be 11 years plus before this takes effect for you, and you'll then be 65 and change as it gradually rises. So there's a very long period, prospectively, for people to adjust to it.
And on the Medicare age in particular, what do you make of the argument that you're, by raising the age, you're taking some of the healthier people out of the pool and reducing the chances for preventive care, which then could lead to higher health costs down the road?
The premise is right, but the conclusion I would argue with, you are taking healthier people out of the pool because the youngest participants are coming out and you're beginning to catch people at a later at a period where their healthcare consumption is higher. But there's nothing preventing them from preventative care in the intervening years. So between 65 and 70, they're either still actively working and they have some sort of program available to them, or they're in an exchange underwritten in large part by the Affordable Care Act or some alternative. So under any of these regimes, access to preventative care ought to be available to them at least as well as it would be under a Medicare regime.
Patty Costello with Bloomberg. Appreciating that Democrats still control the Senate and they'll never support premium support, are you going to prioritize where you put the heft of your resources in terms of these proposals and kind of look at the ones that might have the most chance for bipartisan success?
Well, I would argue that you try to lay out a comprehensive approach, as we've done, and let's start the conversations. Let's begin the conversation. Yeah, your point's a good one. I mean, this has been almost dogma that, you know, we don't want to do this, but, you know, so too we're increasing the inheritance tax base, you know, or keeping that at $5 million, and that became permanent in the tax law, and everybody was opposed to it until they voted for it. You know, so it's I think you start off with, I think, putting a solid comprehensive proposal on the table and then have the conversations. This is often the kind of thing that might come. We've certainly had Senate leaders say to us, look, there's going to be no entitlement reform until the president decides he's going to lead it. You know, that's a factor in all of this. But we'll talk to them as well. There's a whole new economic team is being assembled over there. So,
are you actually feeling optimistic based on what we just experienced?
We're going to have to be persistent more than temperamental in this process, I think. But just going back to the beginning of your question, everyone in this table, around this table, knows more about political dynamics than I do. But remember that the proposal we're making says every senior has the right to choose Medicare if he or she prefers Medicare. It's always there for you. If you think Medicare fee-for-service is the better alternative for you, then raise your hand and it's there for you. There may be private alternatives, and if you choose one of those, then the government is indifferent in the initial stage between funding your choice of the private alternative versus the Medicare alternative. It's really hard for me to see how rational people have a spirited opposition to that idea. Now, I realize they do, but it's awfully hard to see how where that comes from. We recognize that in the current regime, several of our companies in the BRT, they sell Medicare Advantage today. They sell Part D private alternative to the Medicare Part D all the time, quite successfully and quite uneventfully. So the notion that that ought to be extended to the full menu of Medicare plans, maybe that's a hill too hard to high to climb for Washington today, but it's hard for me to see that it isn't worth the effort.
I mean, it is a discussion that's very important to have because, I mean, it wasn't that many years ago that choice in education was considered unthinkable. We went to the public school where you grew up today. You might go there. You might go to a charter public school. In some cases, interesting story, I think, in the journal today about a school up in Vermont that's coming, private school funded publicly. I mean, it's just all kinds of permutations. I think, actually, in an era of technology when we actually can make more informed choices, we ought to allow for the choices to exist. So in an information age, to be so prescriptive and limiting on choices is kind of counterintuitive. And so it's a good conversation to have. And people like Senator Wyden, for example, have been, you know, very open. He's a member of the majority up there. Yeah, he did get beat up pretty good, but, you know, he's persistent, and maybe there will be others. And you know, I think that, you know, again, we're not trying to tailor this so that, nor did we when we sent a letter signed by 80% of the BRC CEOs in December. I mean, we're not one party or the other party. We're, you know, these are CEOs representing companies that represent a significant slice of the American economy and say, look, let's start fixing some of America's problems so America can go out and compete and win. And we think this is a good contribution.
Hi, I'm Jenny from Politico. I'm just wondering, you mentioned that you're going to have to go out and kind of sell your ideas. How do you plan to do that? What's your strongest argument? Who do you plan to talk to?
Well, we plan to talk to leadership in Congress and in the White House, you know, beginning very, very shortly. And I think the strength of the argument is that we can substantially reduce the burden that entitlement growth places on the range of options to solve our fiscal problems through pragmatic and gradual intervention. None of the things we've described today have any kind of cathartic effect on anybody who's a current recipient of these benefits, nor would it have any substantial effect on any recipient in the foreseeable future. The only modification that we've proposed here that would have any even modestly effect, significant effect on anyone, would be a modest deceleration in the cost of living adjustment for existing Social Security benefits. So, and even that is in the neighborhood of $30 or $40 a year, prospectively. So we are all, those of us who are in the BRT, are paid to try to solve very difficult problems effectively. I would tell you that most of them are a lot harder than this, frankly. I mean, there are good solutions to these problems that don't have damaging consequences for those we're trying to support. And if only the political process could lead to that result, I find it very encouraging. I may be the most naive person you've ever met. Certainly possible.
But a lot of these ideas have been suggested before and haven't gotten support, or, you know, one party killed it before the other could get the argument off the ground. Any reason to think it might be different this time?
John, you want to try?
I'm sorry.
Is there any reason to think that the argument on these issues would be different than their historic hearing?
Well,
things like premium support and Social Security modifications?
I think there are different arguments that can be used. I mean, there's a legacy opportunity. Some people are always thinking about that when that's appropriate. That could be an argument. I think that the other time that you do these kinds of changes, which are thought to be politically at, you know, risky, is when you have divided government, so you can do them together. That's often been, you know, argue that nobody will do this by themselves because the other side's going to be against it. This time, can you sit down and work this out? Look, I know it's going to be hard. It's been hard. It's hard listening to the debate right now about spending. But you asked a question earlier about this, about, you know, the first 10 years. I mean, this is not so much, this is long-term, the long-term problem that we're dealing with here. This isn't the annual budget, you know, next year, 2015 budget. But long-term, 60% of the budget's over in the entitlements and therefore untouchable. That will grow. And as your ability to deal with discretionary funds, you know, is increasingly a smaller and smaller part of the budget, you're more and more out of control of what the whole thing looks like. But that's why acting now is important. And so I
would just add one last thing. I think there's nothing like impending pain to focus the mind. And the conditions the American economy faces are much more serious and sustained than in any we've experienced in my lifetime, for example. So we sit with a very high rate of unemployment, an interest rate that's effectively zero, very slow growth, very poor employment prospects for a large number of Americans. And for those that are retired who have $1 million in a CD in their bank, they're earning a little over $10,000 a year in interest. These are not terribly encouraging circumstances. So I think one would hope that you would look at this collection of events and say we've got to break through this and find something that rekindles the country's ability to grow and to sustain employment. And these are, I think, pretty appealing alternative mechanisms to do that. So hopefully we could find some traction.
You think last half of the 20th century growth probably averaged at least 3.5% a year. The first, you know, dozen years of this new century, we're at, I think, 1.33 or something. That was the number I saw in the journal today. So, I mean, it's dramatically reduced, and we need to get that back, because if we could get the 3% growth again, life would look a lot different. A lot more people have better futures because they'd be working. We've got people on the call. Why don't we, Danielle, we'll take your question, but then I want to go to some on the that are on the phone so that I can get them in. So why don't you go ahead and...
Sure, yeah. Getting back to the increasing the retirement age and what you said at Mr. Lovin about how that's consistent with demographic changes. Often when that's brought up, the argument is brought up that this will disproportionately hurt people with lower incomes who have not seen that advancement in life expectancy. And I wonder how you respond to that.
Well, the facts on that are a little tricky. A detailed discussion of demographics will lead one to slumber very quickly. But so we try to make this brief.
Sure.
Low-income folks often have a very poor life expectancy because many of their lives end very young, and this is true disproportionately among men. So if, as I was saying earlier, if a low-income male reaches an age of, let's say, 40, where the likelihood of some sort of violent or accidental death is very low, the life expectancy of such a person versus a higher-income 40-year-old male is that band is dramatically tighter. And for unsurprising reasons, the band among women of both income classes is much tighter to start with.
Mm-hmm.
So that difference does exist, but nonetheless, and there are ways to ameliorate that. So you can have income support or higher degrees of benefit for people that are means-tested in some fashion once the retirement age is reached. But I believe you should not expose either of these two systems to tremendous economic distress because you're concerned that there is a problem you need to solve through another mechanism for a small percentage of equity. So we can do that. If there's a legitimate argument for greater support for low-income individuals during this transition period, I don't think you would find among the CEOs any objection to some additional layer of attention to that group. But I think in the debate, the magnitude of that problem has been very substantially overestimated.
Jose, I know we have a question from the phone, so if you could queue them up, that would be great.
Certainly. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. One moment for the first question on the phone line. And we do have the first question come from Bertha Combs with CNBC. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks. I'm interested in the section about Section 218 on the exemption for state and local workers. How big an impact would this change have? How much do you think this costs in terms of public taxpayer costs right now? And if you could please identify yourself before you speak. It's a little difficult sometimes when you guys switch quickly on the phone.
I'm not sure I'm going to give you – this is Gary Lupton. I'm going to be able to give you a precise answer to that. I'm going to turn to my colleagues here in the room and see, Randy, if you or anyone can parameterize that. Questions around the dollar effect of having a wider population involved in Social Security from state and local employees not currently active in that group?
The proposal gives state and local governments time to adapt to the proposal. Does not go into effect for a few years. And it's only for newly hired employees. So the immediate effect on state and local governments that are affected, and most would not be, is fairly small, although over time it would increase. Overall, it would reduce the 75-year imbalance by something like 8%. So it does make a difference over 75 years. But short-term, not as much.
And this is... And the irony, I mean, earlier we had the question about private accounts and that. This is sort of that question in reverse. So here's a defense, to your point, of private...
I'm sorry, who's speaking?
That's
I'm on the phone,
right.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. That's all right. I've got, with this cold I've got, I don't know what I sound like. But anyway, that's your answer. I don't need to dwell on that anymore.
Hello?
Yep.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the end of the question. I didn't hear who was talking. Sorry.
It was John Engler speaking. John, but he was kind of going off on us.
So do you guys have an estimate in terms of the dollar amount?
Dollar amount, we don't have a dollar amount figure. It's more of an equity provision that everybody ought to be in the system.
It provides, our colleague Randy Harvick was saying, it provides about 8% of the long-term benefit to the 75-year solvency test, but in the near term, in absolute dollars, it's a modest portion of the contribution.
Thanks.
Other questions here at the table or on the line?
We do have a question on the phone line, and it comes from Kevin Hall with McClatchy. Your line is open.
Thanks, and thanks for taking the call. I have a series of kind of technical questions for you. One, why did you guys choose the CPI? On the chain CPI, AARP has been...
We're losing you.
I do apologize. He dropped off. Give me one second.
Well, okay.
You could probably answer the question, Gary. You know where it's going.
And it looked like he actually dropped off, so hopefully he'll dial back in.
Okay, well, let me just say a word about the question. This one is one that I find fascinating. So Social Security, at the time it was initiated, said to seniors, we will protect you against cost of living increases. How do you do that? You find some index that tries to track it. Now, what's being debated here are two indices, one of which prices a fixed basket of goods over time, which is what's currently used. What we're proposing is that you use an index that reflects the rational decisions all of us make in response to changes in relative prices. So to take a trivial example, you will eat ice cream or frozen yogurt. Over time, you like both, but you prefer frozen yogurt. Over time, the price of frozen yogurt goes up. You substitute a bit into ice cream. The fixed basket index does not measure that change and would overcompensate you for the rising price of frozen yogurt. The chain index would say you will move into something close by that is more or less equivalent to you, and it would have a lower rate of escalation. The same would apply to petrol fuels versus natural gas or bicycles versus Vespas or pick your favorite example. So I think at least I would suggest that most people would argue that seniors ought to be compensated for rates of growth in prices over which they can't control their purchasing sensibly, but not for things where there are remedies available to them that are relatively straightforward. The difference historically between these two indices has been about 30 basis points, so say 3% a year versus 2.7. If you're a typical Social Security recipient, you earn about $12,700 a year. So when you got your cost of living adjustment the following year, you would get a 3% bump on $12,700, which, let's call it, for round off sake, $350, versus $320. Now, the difference to a senior of that magnitude, I don't think is a first-order effect, but to the government, because of the number of people involved, it's a dramatic difference. I think most people would agree that if you could institute a change like that and have it sustain Social Security over a long period of time, everyone would raise, I think most everyone, perhaps not the AARP, but others, would raise their hand and say that's probably a pretty good way to contribute.
No, they want CPIE. You want to address that one?
Well, CPIE is an even more arcane notion that we construct an index that is specifically geared to the circumstances of the elderly. Some efforts have been made to do that. So far, they have had a pretty tough time coming up with a stable index of that sort. If such an index were to reflect substitution in the way the chain index does, I wouldn't personally have an objection to it. But I do think whatever index is used needs to be the one that reflects the core effect of inflation on elderly expenses, recognizing their ability to make these decisions, not simply an index that suggests that they don't.
Our caller is back with us still.
What happened?
Yeah. Hi, can you guys hear me? Yeah, sorry about that. I'm not sure what went wrong there. But it sounds like you got that first one taken care of on the CPI.
You got back in time to get the answer, right?
Yeah, I got most of it, yeah. Okay. And the other related technical questions, one was,
it didn't look like you advocated any raising of the caps as a way to get revenue. That would certainly be one way you could very quickly raise on the Social Security side the revenue. And the other question was the 55 cutoff. Some have argued that 55 is arguably 10 to 12 years from current retirement age, depending on where you are in the baby boom years. That's well past half of your working life, and it's kind of changing. Some people see that as changing the rules real late in the game. How does it change your equation if you moved it to 50 or 45?
Let me take both of those, and Randall and John can jump in. I think if you're today just under 55, nothing is going to happen for 10 years, and the escalation in the retirement age will not be immediately from 65 to or 67 to 70. It'll be just a few months later, and the change in the retirement age will feather in over a very long period of time. So I think it would be very hard to argue that any of us has enough predictability in our lives that change would be jolting to the way we think about our futures. Cass. So this goes back to the question Lori Montgomery raised a little bit earlier. The economy is very weak. Higher rates of taxation on current wage earners is generally not conducive to higher rates of growth in employment generation. So if you're trying to solve what is fundamentally a demographic problem, the reason we have the Social Security problem is because of the changing demographic. You ought to solve it demographically, not through tax policy, in my view. So something that has a short-term effect on employment that's negative is not a very good remedy to what is a long-term demographic problem that can be solved through other means.
There also was, I think, a 3.8% hike as part of the Affordable Care Act that's taking effect. So that's a new tax hike that's coming in on the Medicare funding side.
Okay. And does this in any way, your proposal today, how does it rank in terms of importance compared to corporate tax reform, which now looks fairly flatlining? Where would you put this in place?
I would just say that we're this first quarter of the year is going to be apparently devoted to a lot of talk about spending reforms and budget issues, and this is very timely for that conversation. And the other priorities are very important. We've got several priorities. I mean, one of the challenges for Congress is there's a lot of work that's been left undone for a long period of time. And so whether you look at tax reform on business taxes, or Chairman Camp and Chairman Baucus have both been here at recent meetings, and they'd like to improve the entire tax code, both the business taxes as well as individual taxes. Speaker Boehner and Senator McConnell made it pretty clear that now will have to be done in the context of you can reform the taxes, but we're not signing up for new tax hikes. So we got a lot of issues swirling around there. We've got energy policy. We've got immigration reform. We've got a whole list of issues that I think are important. Plus, you've got ongoing all the implementation of Affordable Care and of Dodd-Frank. So there's no shortage of priorities here at the roundtable.
Interesting times.
Very much so.
Montgomery.
Is that one technical question and one broader question? On Social Security, did you look at the early retirement age at all in your analysis? And the broader question is, there are some people on the Hill and off the Hill arguing right now that these issues are so critical to our economic future that they should take precedence over raising the debt ceiling. Is the debt ceiling to be the moment to tackle these questions? And I know you expressed an opinion about that. I'm just wondering if this is bordering on the irrational from your point of view, or whether it makes sense to take it.
Well, I'm going to take the first one while John gathers himself for the second one. We want to have a proposal for Social Security that has the greatest effects with the smallest number of controversial issues. So modification to the early retirement age, although perhaps beneficial, is not as meaningful to the long-term solvency of the program as the things that we propose. So we have tried to gather three or four, we believe, very pragmatic, despite their political firepower, relatively straightforward proposals that do the trick. Now, a la carte, would we favor some modification to that? After some deliberation, I suppose we probably would. But we don't see it as an essential part of the plan that meets the goals we sought to address.
Yeah, just like we didn't tackle disability, I mean, there increasingly are a lot of questions about the, you've got safer workplaces everywhere, less physical labor being done in aggregate, yet disability rates soaring. So, I mean, there are questions there. We didn't get any of that, as Gary said. Those will still be there, and they can be looked at any time the Congress chooses. As far as the leverage of the debt ceiling, I think just say I think the premise that this is really important is accurate. I think it needs to be dealt with. I just don't think the United States is going to not pay the interest on our debts, or we're going to stop paying our vendors and our creditors. So at some point, that gets resolved. And so can that be a leverage point? I just don't see how that works. On the other hand, if we want to have a trajectory on spending and annual budgets, and if we get back to the practice of actually having an annual budget, it seems to me these are important things to be putting in there, and that there ought to be ways to think about what are the priorities in those annual budgets and how this could be blended together. And are there things that in a political process where there's give and take, can they be worked out? I mean, there are always more spending priorities than there is money available, but is there some way to at least meet some of those while at the same time dealing with these long-term problems? Because if they don't, this crowds out eventually all the spending. Again, it could happen after everybody's gone from the current Congress, years in the future. But I think everyone's seen enough pictures coming out of Europe and places like that where you have to make really hard decisions and your time frame is very compressed. And Randall, I think, you've talked about just the challenge of managing I think he has the largest single private health care bill in America. I mean, you've had to make hard decisions.
Yeah, I would suggest, John, that corporate America has, by and large, made the really difficult decisions required to deal with these realities. And to your point, we insure 1.2 million lives health insurance-wise, and it's not easy. The decisions aren't easy, but I think what corporate America has shown is by using the power of competition, and it's very important that the power of competition be utilized for addressing this, it is possible to provide the same level of health care or even an improved level of health care without the employee, retiree, or the company's health care continuing to grow at these same out-of-control rates. And we have done it, and AT&T is not alone. I know a large bodies of employees across America have had to deal with this, and it is achievable, it is doable. Gary made the observation earlier that in corporate America we have to deal with some very difficult decisions and problems. The fix for the entitlement situation we're discussing here does not rise to the level of some of the more difficult problems we deal with, and this is a resolvable issue. It's just going to take some courage and fortitude and commitment to addressing it.
I think one of the things that I would expect from the political process, and Tina, we got one more question, two more?
There's no more from the
phone. Okay, well, no more from the phone, so I think we can wrap up here. But is that this could be scored, this could now be turned into a proposal, and then the opportunity for other people to bring forward their proposals and score. I mean, one of the things that the debates have suffered from, in my view, is a shortage of actual proposals. There's a lot of conversation about how serious the problem is, but let's put proposals on the table, and people should bring forward their ideas to resolve these problems, and let's see what they're like. I think just saying no doesn't get us there. Last question. All right, Amy, get last one.
Hi, I'm Amy Lotman with Inside Health Policy, and I had a couple questions. The first was about the retirement age. And I'm just wondering, how does that impact your businesses if you keep people on for another, like, 5 extra years? How much would that cost your members?
Well, I think Randall will probably give a more precise answer than I do, but we cover about 80% of the cost of the total health care expenditure of our employees each year. So if you imagine that that's in the neighborhood of, say, $10,000 or $12,000 annually, then it adds, and I'm making that number up a little bit, please don't quote me on it, but whatever that number is, then that's going to add 5 times 80% of that number to annual expense. The evidence shows that Americans are working longer, often in very different types of careers, in different types of industries, and the gradual extension of eligibility for Medicare, I think, makes perfect sense in that context. Our members are prepared to take on the additional cost of insuring people as they work later in life quite happily. I think that strikes me as the inevitable consequence of a population that lives longer and healthier. It's exactly what you want.
Yeah, that's well said. I would go a step further, too, and that is there is an incremental cost to corporate America from this, but by that same token, over the time horizons that we're discussing, 10 to 25 years out, corporate America is going to have to discern and figure out how to keep those employees productive longer. And I think just demographically, that's going to be achievable. So while there's an incremental health care cost, you anticipate that the average employee is going to be productive a longer period of time. So it's not like it's just incremental health care costs. There should be productive use of our workforce as well for a longer period.
Your second question?
The second question had to do with the injecting more competition into Medicare and Medicare Advantage. Did you guys think about a benchmark for the premiums for the premium support to start and a growth rate? Because that's where the problem is.
Most of the premium support model suggests that you open competition among private providers in a defined geography and you allow them to bid on what the premium would be for certain types of recipients, and then the government picks, for example, the second lowest of the proposals among the competing groups, and there's some quality certification occurs to suggest that the Amy healthcare company is capable of providing this service properly, and that becomes the numeraire. That becomes the premium, and the company then has to show that it can provide care to the recipient under those terms. And in the Medicare Advantage market, which exists buoyantly today, those companies have been able to provide those services quite effectively and generally return a modest surplus at the end of the premium period. So we would envision something of that sort.
Okay, so you'd link it to the second lowest plan?
It's something like that. I'm not absolutely tethered to the second lowest plan, but something that allows robust competition to put pressure on the cost of the program.
Okay, and what about the rate of growth?
Well, the rate of growth would be linked to what the providers believe they have to charge each year to be able to sustain that. So every year the provider would have to consider what they would have to charge the population to sustain those services, and that would be, in fact, the rate of growth. I would prefer a model of that sort rather than one where there's an administered escalator.
Okay, so more like the Corker plan?
I don't know what this is.
I'm not sure. I think I believe that would be just way too specific for us today.
Okay.
Thank you. So I do want to emphasize that when you look, many of you have in detail, at the way in which care is provided in a highly heterogeneous way across geographies under Medicare, and you see the dramatic differences in cost for the provision of the same service, I think everyone would have to agree that competition would bring a certain level of rationality to that. And in this proposal, at the risk of repeating myself, the senior in every geography would always be able to choose Medicare if he or she chose that to be preferable. So there would always be a publicly provided benchmark alternative. And I think in that, it's hard to argue that there would be any damage to allowing the private case to be provided as a choice.
Now, are you envisioning, I apologize, are you envisioning like Medicare exchanges? Medicare exchanges in the same way that it will be.
I don't know whether it would constitute an exchange. I think it would be like Medicare Advantage is today. So if you live in a geography where there's a private provider of a Medicare program that's called Medicare Advantage, you would be able to elect which of these two you chose to consider.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank everyone. You've been very patient. This is a substantive topic, and thanks for the questions and for your attendance today. Thank you. Randall, anything else you want to say as we say goodbye?
No, I don't believe so, John. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Randall, and thank you, Gary.
Thanks, Randall.
Okay. Do you have
Thank you for your participation in today's conference call. The call has concluded. You may go ahead and disconnect at this time.